So my thanks to the organizers for the chance to attend and speak. I wanted to tell you about some experiments on a dense granular flow in a geometry, something like this. So this is work done mainly by two undergraduate students from Smith College, Emily Gardell and Ellen Keane, and in collaboration with my colleague, Professor Ishwar at Smith College. So the main preoccupation of my talk for the next 15-20 minutes would be to try and talk about the state of flow in a system like this as you approach jamming by, say, constricting the waist of this flow. Okay. So I will echo several issues raised in the first talk of the day by Bob Berenger that try and look at how you approach this jamming transition, but probably from a fairly different place in parameter space. So we're going to be coming from very much above jamming towards jamming, and these will be systems with fairly stiff, hard particles like glass and steel and things like that. So we're going to be looking at this in experimental geometries that look like these. Basically, what I will be reporting for you is sort of kinematics in all of these in systems like these, along with measurements of the wall force, okay, that go with the kinematics. I will, for this talk, mainly be focusing on this system, which is a quasi-two-dimensional system. I'll tell you a little bit more about that. At some level, these 3D systems show a much richer variety of phenomena, and in some ways our measurements have gotten better and have more dimensions to them, but this is the stuff on which we have the most data and probably the cleanest complete story to tell you about. I'd be happy to take questions about what these situations look like. So the thing that I would like to ask is, you know, in all these flows, it doesn't matter to what extent the reservoir above these that feed these objects are filled to, there's a time-independent flow density through these systems, which says that, of course, that the walls support essentially the weight of these things as they flow down. So in some ways, as you constrict this opening or that opening or whatever you're doing down here, the average force doesn't change too much, the average force exerted on the walls, except to the extent that there's some slight change in the density of the system as you go towards jamming. And yet, qualitatively, the behavior of the system changes quite a bit. So as you get to the point where you allow only a trickle of these things through the bottom, you start seeing big correlated fluctuations in the flow velocity through the system. And therefore, obviously, the wall force, which is supporting all these, which is sort of supporting the weight of the stuff, will also fluctuate accordingly. So what we're going to do now is look at both fluctuations in flow velocity and in force and see if they carry in them some signature of an impending arrest as this thing is closed down to really small dimensions. Okay. The other thing we'll try and do is not just look at the force fluctuations in time or in amplitude, but we'd also like to see if they have some kind of spatial organization to them of the sort that was discussed this morning. So this is sort of an old picture of what these force chains might look like in a three-dimensional system. As you heard and as you saw examples of, objects like this survive when you apply quasi-static shear to them, and probably are very important in having walls communicate with each other. So I'm going to be asking whether you still see hints of this behavior when you're well above, and when you're in a system that isn't quasi-static, in which there's a lot of inertia, in which flows are just rattling down, and as you sort of approach these kind of states. Okay? So in almost everything that I will tell you in the two-dimensional system, inertia is actually very important. Things are really flowing pretty fast. So now let me take you to the experimental system. So this is the kind of system we look at. It's a wedge, roughly pretty two-dimensional. You fill steel beads in a large reservoir above, and it's admitted into this wedge-shaped geometry, and it flows out the bottom over here. The one thing you control about the flow is this opening, where the inclination angle is fixed. Okay, so what you get to vary is this, and in our experiments we vary it from 16 bead diameters, at which the flow is order of meter a second, so it's flowing like this, to maybe 3 bead diameters, where you can no longer, below that you can sort of no longer get steady flows without tapping it. Okay. And there things are moving at a few centimeters a second. Okay. So still pretty fast, actually. So measurements we will make will be a video of the flow field in here. It will stay a pretty dense system throughout this regime that I'm talking about. And this flow velocity will stay constant as this hopper drains, and I won't be talking about the unsteady regime right at the end. The first set of measurements I'd like to tell you about are measurements of normal force exerted on the wall over here. So there's a transducer here, and the head of the transducer accommodates one particle on it. So it's about the same size as a particle, so you get either one or no particle on that transducer at a given time. And it's sensitive only to normal force. So let me give you an example of what the force placed here looks like as a function of time in this time-independent state. So it looks like something like this over a run of maybe 10 seconds. So that's transducer voltage against time. So it's normal force against time, roughly speaking. If you blow up a little region in here and you look over 10 milliseconds, you'll actually see that the trace is made up of clearly defined peaks. Okay. And there is some sort of separation of time. Here is the width of each peak, which corresponds to an impact of a ball against the transducer, is much less than the time between collisions, than the typical time between collisions, let me say, which is much less than the time for a ball to pass the transducer, to flow past the transducer. Okay, so there are multiple collisions in this trace from one ball on a transducer. So this thing hits the face of the transducer tens of times, okay, before it goes away. So the first thing I'm going to ask is whether there are characteristics of just this force trace that tell you something about whether you're approaching arrest by as a function of flow velocity as you shut down this opening at the bottom. Okay. So to start off with, what I would like to tell you about is the probability distribution of these impulses. Okay. And let me emphasize that at all the flow rates we're talking about, even the ones very close to where a permanent arch forms at the bottom, in this two-dimensional geometry, the flow is collisional. Basically, you see individual separated peaks like this. The story is a bit more complicated in three dimensions. Yes, please. It goes negative because the transducer rings. So that's something we have to pull out. I've shown you the raw data, actually. It's about three orders of magnitude. The time resolution of the transducer? It's very close to here. Okay. So in fact, what you have to do is you have to do this by calibration. You have to impart known impulses to this and back out. Okay. So the response time of the transducer is only modestly smaller than this. It's comparable to the collision time. So you actually have to calibrate that. This is a calibrated device for these hard collisions. Yes, please.
Is the 10 millisecond time scale roughly the shear rate? If I look elsewhere in the hopper.
Come back to that, please. I'm not processing the numbers quickly enough. I should have an answer to your question. Okay, so what I've shown you is the probability distribution of these impulses against the transducer as a function of the value of those impulses. This is for many, many flow rates, both very rapid flows and flows pretty close to jamming. Each of them are scaled out by their average. Okay, and as you can see, the high force end of this distribution is pretty exponential. If you really want to see how exponential it is, you could do a better job at some flow rate. And it's actually quite a nice exponential. Okay. this is a probability distribution of the impulses. I can do forces coarse-grained. For the reason that you asked about, I cannot actually resolve instantaneous force, but then nothing can. So this is the fastest time scale I can get to.
But given that it's collisional, don't we care much more about impulses than about forces?
Yes, I think this is the natural object to plot from the data. If you actually look at the high end of the force distribution is pretty exponential. If you look at the low end, it sort of evolves with the flow rate. As you increase the flow velocity, this thing dips down a little bit. But there's really no clear signature of the approach of jamming just in the static force distribution. Okay. There's no time information folded into this, right? There's no temporal information folded into this. Yes, please?
How do you integrate your impulse over the time that it takes to cross the time
that you get the same? Yes, not very different results. Yes. Let me talk about that a little bit. So the next thing I would like to show you is actually the distribution of impulse times between impulses. Okay. So I want to show you that piece of temporal information. And that's actually kind of a broader distribution. Something funny happened over there, but this is the probability distribution as a function of time. And as you get closer and closer to jamming, this thing actually broadens the distribution. And if you get as close to jamming as you can without actually having to tap to dislodge stuff, it actually makes a reasonably nice power law. I have troubles with 1.5s in my life, but this is another 1.5. So if this is literally true, of course this will get cut off by the kind of thing you're saying. It gets cut off by the passage time of a bead across the transducer. But if this thing is to be taken literally, it says sort of the average of this divergence. This has also been noticed in simulations by Denniston and Lee of a very similar system. So the thing I wanted to say, just looking at the forces, just the force fluctuations, is that there is, you know, pretty clear dynamical signature of jamming from the time interval distribution. But we don't really see a nice static signature. You can't look at the probability distribution of forces in the way you asked for, or impulses, and get something that looks nice. And in the tail, you do get this exponential force distribution as a function of flow rate. So one thing we would like to know is, how does all of this connect up with the kinematics? As I said, and as you know, qualitatively, as you get more and more clogged in a flow, there's sort of bigger, more bursty flows. Next thing you might ask is, does all of this have any spatial organization to it? Is there anything about force change that we can back out? Of course, we can only measure forces at the boundaries. Okay, so it'll obviously be some slightly indirect way of getting at things. So what I'm going to show you are video measurements that are synchronized with these measurements. These are done at sort of moderately fast speeds, and they're done very locally. Okay, so we take forces here, and we measure by video here, or here, or here, or here, along the side of this, or into the flow. Okay, and of course, to just get the whole flow field, we can take relatively slow videos of the whole thing. So I wanted to tell you, this is a very dense system, so even though I will show you velocities, those are sort of, don't be taken in by the fact that the video rate is fast. I'm not showing you quote-unquote temperature fluctuations. This is still at the collision time. So things have collided several times, okay? This is done because you want to track well, rather than because you want to resolve ballistic motion between collisions, okay? So I'm now going to show you some general features of the velocity. So the blue stuff is the velocity along the flow direction with the average subtracted. And the red stuff is sort of perpendicular to the flow direction. So if I look at a histogram of that, there are two sorts of general features I'd like to point out. This is not the flow rate that is closest to jamming, but it's a fairly small opening by this time. It's four diameters, four bead diameters in the bottom. The flow in the direction of the velocity fluctuations in the direction of the flow are quite broad. The average flow velocity is 16 centimeters a second, and you can see that the flow sometimes almost stops. okay? And sometimes goes to sort of double its speed. The velocity autocorrelation function at any point, so this is a pretty long-lived fluctuation. These blue curves have fairly long-lived fluctuations. So these are sort of hydrodynamic times. That's hundreds of collision times, okay? So these are two sort of general features that I want to tell you about the velocity fluctuations. Yes, please? That is my idiocy, yes. This is meter per second. That speed of light is one here, the C goes next. AB. Yes. Oh no. Same question?
Does it behave at the distance between peaks in the previous plot?
No, it's many, many peaks.
So how does it grow when it goes? I suppose it grows when it goes to the jamming.
It grows when you go to jamming, yes. But not by a huge amount. Okay. So the thing is that power law has a very nicely defined shape, but it's very strongly cut off. So in the experiment, if you actually go and measure the mean correlation time, aside from just looking at the distribution, it doesn't grow, you know, hugely fast. So if you plot this correlation function between the slow flows and the fast flows, it actually doesn't change that much. Okay. You were going to ask something.
We're going to find this very unlikely.
Yes.
I mean, how does this correlation time compare to zero?
And I don't find it obnoxious. I feel apologetic that I don't have a ready answer for you. I'll get back to.
If I'm right, the reason I say that is because what you said at the beginning, which you said, well, collision time is 500 microseconds. And then you were quoting things in the tens of milliseconds for how long a ball took it to go by. And so if you assume that that's kind of a lower bound on the hero, the hundreds of collision times, it's
not far from the shear rate.
Yeah, yeah. It might be pretty close.
It's the right order of magnitude. Time.
So where are you looking at?
I'm staying at one point in the flow and measuring the flow velocity.
Where is that? Anywhere.
I gave you a representative point, but we do it at many, many points in the flow.
So it's not necessarily close to the wall or anything, it could be in the middle.
It could be in the middle.
Okay.
Right. Yes? No, it doesn't. It doesn't change much. Okay. So actually, there is not much information here. If I stare at this plot as a function of flow velocity, which I should have put on here to answer all these questions, you actually don't see a huge effect going on. 5 minutes, then no more questions from you lot. You can also look at spatial correlations of the flow. And actually, it's a very correlated flow. So I'm taking correlations between flow velocity at the transducer and at many other points along the wall, upstream and downstream. And this is how the correlation function decays. So it's still not decay to zero when you're, you know, 15 ball diameters away. And this decays even slower as you go towards jamming. Okay? Likewise, these are correlations, spatial correlations, moving into the bulk of the flow, away from the wall, into the flow. Okay? So velocity fluctuations get sort of increasingly correlated, spatially correlated, as you get closer to jamming. And now I want to put these two together and ask how the force fluctuation and the velocity fluctuations go together. In particular, we're going to correlate the velocity fluctuation with either the average force or the collision frequency at the boundary. If you do that, if you do the equal time correlation of collision frequency and flow velocity, you find the following thing. You find that at all flow rates, these are negatively correlated. That's to say, the flow velocity slows down when the force is large. or the flow velocity slows down when collisions are frequent, you'd look unsurprised, as you have every right to be. But in principle, it could have gone the other way also. If you have sort of a hot mobile region passing the transducer, that will deliver large impulses too. So I think this is actually a finding, but it's a reasonable finding. So it's okay to nod your head. So the flow of the transducer slows down when the impulses are frequent and large. And now I want to ask what this this looks like spatially. So I'm going to make equal-time correlations between the force at one spot and the velocity at different places. Okay. So I'm going to measure the force here, and I'm going to measure correlated with velocity fluctuations along here. Likewise, I'm going to measure the force here and correlate it with the velocity along this line at equal times. And you can see what that looks like. That negative correlation of the transducer decays away in a few bead diameters as you go upstream and downstream of it. It decays away much slower when you go across in this direction. That's to say, velocity over here is still pretty anti-correlated with force over here. Okay? And it really only decays to within our error bars when you get to the opposite wall. So this is what you get from the equal time correlations. Now I'm going to ask about force and velocity at unequal times. Okay? But first, just to summarize, in the flow direction, correlations, I just said this. So you see something like this. You see a picture like this in simulations as well. These are simulations with no friction, just event-driven collisional stuff. You see the transient appearances of things, structures that look like that that vanish. So let me move on to the next thing, which is unequal time stuff that I wanted to show you. So this is velocity fluctuations at one point correlated with force fluctuations at the same point, let's say, as a function of time. So the negative fluctuation I showed you was at equal time over here. But what you can see from the graph is that actually the force has gone large before the velocity slows down. Okay? So forces build up several collision times before the velocity drops out and dies down sort of seconds later. And I wish I had told this to you in units that you like. Big one? Now you can do this with as a function of position in space also, right? And what you see is that these correlations get communicated upstream very rapidly. So if you ask, so these are curves, these are force velocity correlations as a function of time for many positions. This is the curve I just showed you. This is for force and velocity measured at the same spot. If you correlate force and velocity measured upstream, then the correlation value drops. But it takes a long time to drop. You can go 15 diameters, ball diameters upstream. And it hasn't decayed very fast, even though the equal time correlation looked like it was dropping really fast. Okay? And if you actually plot these maximum times and ask how quickly these fluctuations are communicated upstream, that's very fast. It's really coherently communicated. It happens at many times the flow speed. Flow speed probably comparable to a sound velocity in this. It's really of this order of magnitude. It's diameter divided by collision frequency. It's like one solid object communicating force upstream. So to summarize, I wanted to show you that the time interval distribution shows some signatures of jamming, but the P of force and the P of impulse doesn't. Force and velocity are strongly anti-correlated in everything we've measured, even far away from jamming. The spatial correlations as you get close to jamming are very anisotropic, and they're sort of consistent with chain-like objects that reach across the flow, transverse to the flow, but that are pretty thin in the direction of the flow. So even though these are thin objects, and even though the force fluctuations are very short-lived, their effects on the kinematics are long range in space and are slow to die away. Okay. So that's the final point I wanted to make. Forget about that. Okay. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Now you want to know about the shear rate. That's true. There's a, the degree of crystallinity sort of varies over this thing. But at least the force distributions and the impulse distributions don't seem to be sensitive to that crystallinity. So you can move the transducer up and down. This huge task of sort of mapping spatial correlations between velocity and force we haven't done at many positions. Entirely possible. Entirely possible. So one thing I should point out from the simulations, though, those chains that showed up in the simulations, they're not along crystalline axes. There are many collisions between chains of particles that aren't actually along crystalline axes, or at least along low order crystalline axes. That's true. So we don't see a lot of traffic waves in the velocity. Okay, so we actually don't see that. Stress is harder to tell. The force correlation dies away on very, very short time scales. So if it's there in the force, it's really buried in the noise. It's not a striking feature of the data. Please.
That kind of comment, I mean, this is interesting thing that you mentioned lately. When you said the particle collides about a couple of tens of time before it passes, and it kind of reminds me of the little cartoon that I was showing
make
everything approach to the mean. So I mean, if you think have that kind of picture in your mind, basically you have about a strain. Unit strain, the time associated with unit strain to basically, you know, restart everything, so that gives your correlation time. And basically you got this correlated motion, so as you collide, you're losing the velocity. And the fact that you have a delay between forces and velocities is simply saying that when you start with a heavy force, that tends to bring you back to the saturation. So there might be some relationship between the ratio of those kinetics that Thomas was mentioning, basically the fact that the strain rate, you know, the universe of the strain is playing the role, you know, this important time scale of
breaking these things, of breaking these things. Yes.
There seems to be a strong connection to that, this concept of repeated collisions between neighbors allows you to build up this correlation.
Yes, I mean, there's a reason I showed you actually frequency rather than force. Force has all the same trends, but it's much, much more strongly seen in the frequency. So it's really, the mental picture I carry around is actually a frequently colliding chain like this.
Thank you.